Today's podcast is sponsored by GenesisCare, national independent cancer care provider and experts in breast health, diagnostics and treatments.
Hello and welcome to And Then Came Breast Cancer, the podcast for everyone whose life has been touched by the disease. I'm Victoria Derbyshire and my world changed in 2015 when I was diagnosed. I leant on so many people, friends, family and of course the medical staff who ultimately saved my life. The Future Dreams Breast Cancer Charity believes that no one should face this disease on their own and so wanted to create a podcast series which would be there 24 hours a day. An honest friend, not just for you, but for your own family and friends who are also looking for guidance, support and possibly answers. We have literally talked about so many subjects and there are so many more subjects to go. Today's episode in our third series of the podcast is another one of those frank conversations because we are actually going to talk about sex. What does a cancer diagnosis mean for your most intimate moments, especially because for many of us, our bodies change. And that can affect our confidence. As always, we'll keep the tradition going of asking our guests to introduce themselves. Hello.
Hello, Victoria. My name is Fiona. I'm 47 now, but I was 41 when I got diagnosed with breast cancer. I'm a teacher by trade, I'm a science teacher, but I also teach musical theatre and I'm in my third year of training to be a counsellor.
Hello, Victoria. My name is Emma. I work for Ann Summers as Business Affairs and Crisis Management. And
Crisis Management for Ann Summers?
Oh, there's a lot of crisis management.
Oh, you can imagine. That's a whole other podcast.
Well, I'm going to be asking that question later on in this one. Do carry on. Sorry.
Fiona and I have been together 20 years, married for 10, and we have two wonderful children, 14-year-old and an 11-year-old.
Why did you get married after 10 years?
It was always the plan to get married, yeah. Wasn't it?
We just did everything backwards.
Hmm. Yeah, it was like, do you spend money on a wedding or do you spend money on having children? Obviously, costs a lot of money when you're in a same-sex relationship. So the money at the time went on having babies because obviously we could get married at any age.
Right. But, yeah. And costs a lot of money because of what, IVF? Pay for IVF? Yeah. IVF. Understood. Okay. Hello, Lisa.
Hi.
Welcome
I'm
back.
Lisa. Thank you so much. It's been a while. It's lovely to be back. So I'm Lisa. I am 40 and I was diagnosed with secondary breast cancer 6.5 years ago. And I've been married to Ewan for I think it's 15 years, but I'm now thinking, God, have I got that wrong?
Well, Ewan, in a different part of your house, but the same room on a different Zoom link, is smiling away as you get that wrong. Is she right, Ewan, or is she wrong?
It's been 13 and a half years. Ah. I know it feels longer, darling.
Yeah, it does. No, in a good way. So, yes, I am married to Ewan, who is also joining us today.
Hi, Ewan.
Hi, I'm Ewan. And say I've been married to Lisa for 13 and a half years. We've been together for 15, though, in fairness, which is probably why you're getting confused. So I'm 42, also from Edinburgh, and I'm a lawyer by trade. And Lisa and I have got an 11-year-old Cameron together.
Louise, hi.
Hey, hi, I'm Louise. I got diagnosed with breast cancer in 2011. And I thought I want to give the other side, not talk about the misery, the chemo, the bald heads, whatever. So I wrote a book called All About Boobs, A User's Guide to Breast Cancer and Sex, which is a love story.
Okay, I am going to start with Fiona and Lisa. Fiona, in your introduction, did you even mention breast cancer?
I don't think I did.
Okay.
I was diagnosed in 2018. I don't know. I still think that it's probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. And I know that sounds really, really weird. But I think just because your perspective on life changes. I think it brought us much, much closer together.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Hands down.
100% much closer together. And just because of all the amazing people that I've met throughout and since, I volunteer with someone like me for Breast Cancer Now. I was really lucky to be one of the models in the show last year. And the amazing women that I meet through that is just so inspiring. Okay. And I just, yeah, I don't know. It's just, I don't know, it's weird.
It's not weird. It's how you feel. And yeah. That's absolutely legit. It really is. What I want to ask both you and Lisa, though, is at the moment when you were told, when you were diagnosed, a million things go through your head, not least, certainly in my case, shit, am I going to die? How far down that list for each of you, Fiona and Lisa, was what happens to my sex life? Was it on the list at all?
I don't think it was to start off with. I didn't think about how it would affect it, if at all. Just because you're too busy thinking about the children, thinking about Emma, thinking about my mum, because we had only lost my dad 6 months before to cancer. And so I was thinking about all of those things, thinking about, oh my God, you know, what am I going to do with my job? And, you know, am I going to be able to still go to work after everything is finished? And I think because we were pretty strong anyway, I didn't necessarily think that things would be affected.
What about you, Lisa?
Sex-wise.
Yeah. Lisa?
Yeah, no, to be perfectly honest, I think because when I was diagnosed de novo, so with primary and secondary at the same time. And at the point of my diagnosis, I was kind of thrown into this snowball of surgeries because it had broken my spine, it had broken my neck, it had, you know, so that first few years was constant surgeries because we then, you know, 6 months later, I had brain progression. And I was too focused on actually getting through staying alive at that time. And I think it was really for me personally about 3-4 years into, you know, my diagnosis that we actually, you know, started to think about even having any sort of intimacy. We've always been exceptionally close in terms of support. I mean, Ewan is my absolute rock, you know, and has been there by my side this entire journey. But, you know, a sexual relationship was something that I wasn't well enough for us to even consider. And yeah, it was really only the last couple of years that, you know, touch wood, my disease has been more stabilized, that, you know, we've started to even have those discussions and try and establish any sort of physical relationship, which has been extremely difficult. I think, you know, we'd both admit to that.
Ewan, I wonder if you remember the first time you discussed having sex again, or not even sex, but anything intimate with Lisa after she'd gone through that, you know, absolutely traumatic diagnosis and various elements of treatment.
Yeah, to be honest, it was one of those conversations which I was probably scared to bring up and still am in many ways. Lisa's absolutely right. For the first 2.5, 3 years of her diagnosis, being brutally honest, and Lisa didn't say this, but, you know, when she was diagnosed, she was pretty much given 6 months. And here we are, 6.5, 7 years down the line. So it was never, you know, it was never of importance, to be brutally honest, because the main important thing was, let's do everything within our power to make sure that Lisa's still here, let alone anything else. So it was really only, you know, a little bit later on that, you know, things had stabilized and you kind of go back to normal, whatever normal is, in relation to life. And it was one of those conversations which, to be honest, I was not comfortable having at all, was not comfortable raising, because it felt very selfish.
Did you raise it, or was it Lisa?
It was probably me who raised it first.
So you weren't thinking it was that selfish then?
But I think, and especially the relationship, the kind of relationship that we have, the kind of marriage that we have, the kind of, I suppose, the guy that I am as well, maybe one of my faults, is that I would almost raise it as a joke.
Yeah.
But then actually raising it as a joke is probably 10 times worse, because I was always wary that there was a massive amount of guilt on Lisa's shoulders about this type of thing. And what was strange about it, you know, about the sex and the intimacy, was we knew things were different. And we knew that things felt different. When I say felt different, I mean both felt in relation to emotionally and physically as well. And to be honest, we never really started the discussion until one of our medical team, and this was about 4 or 5 years into diagnosis, when, you know, we were discussing this type of thing with them, and they said, oh, well, of course sex is going to be harder. It's going to be really sore on Lisa because of X, Y, and Z. This drug she's on is going to change the way her whole body works, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all going to be really different for you. And it was almost at that point we looked at each other and took a breath and went, God, it's taken about 4.5, 5 years to actually have this conversation. Finally, someone's saying, right, this is why it's wrong. This is not why it's wrong. This is why it's different. This is why it feels strange. And that was sort of the baseline, I think, that we needed to then go, right, we know now why things are different. We know how it's going to be different. What can we do to try and work it going forward? Yeah.
Emma, what about you? Do you remember discussing it or bringing it into the conversation?
Yes, very much so. Firstly, I think it's incredibly sad that a couple should go so long because there's not the tools or the support from the doctors to bring that up until 4 years in. So I do feel for you. I think I was at an advantage. I work for Ann Summers. Mm-hmm. We were in the process, actually, or Jacqueline Gold was in the process of launching MyViv, which was a range purely for breast cancer ladies. And we spoke a lot about that. Fiona was lucky to be part of focus groups for the MyViv product as well. So I think just...
Sorry, what is the MyViv product?
MyViv stands for My Very Important Vagina.
Okay.
So when Jacqueline Gold was diagnosed in 2016,
yeah,
she, similar to Lisa and Ewan, realised that there wasn't... People didn't really speak about intimacy or even self-love, not just being in a couple, but self-love and sexual health during cancer. So... she brought out a range of products to support that. So,
do you mean vibrators?
Well, it was a mix of self-love and self-care. So self-care was about bath salts, candles, massage oils. And then there was the lubricants, so the more medical side of stuff.
Right.
Obviously, a massive symptom of going through chemotherapy is vaginal dryness. Mm-hmm. So there was a range of lubricants as well. And then, yes, there were softer sex toys which could help explore you again and
Understood.
Find your new sexual desires
Normal.
Or
yeah.
what your new sexual norm is.
Yeah.
So I think that did help. Mm. We are a very intimate couple anyway. So it did pause for a very long time and it wasn't necessarily discussed, but obviously it's a same-sex relationship. Our intimacy is very different or can be very different. And I don't want to be stereotypical, guys, so I apologise if I'm coming across this way. But Fiona used to joke to me. She used to say, oh, if you were a man, you would have left me by now. And I'd be like, well, why? And it all went back to that penetrative sex. And obviously, as a gay couple, we don't need to have penetrative sex. And I'm sure you guys don't either. But it does help. I'm sure you were thinking there. So there are other ways that we... outside of breast cancer, we're intimate without the penetrative sex as well. And we just found other ways of being intimate.
Yeah.
And that was what was important for us, and just lots of talk. But obviously that was supported by what I was doing at work as well.
I mean, you're joking, but I do know of people whose partners have left them. Broadly speaking, it happens to be a man who's left a woman, but I'm sure it happens in same-sex relationships as well when there is a cancer diagnosis. Lisa, Ewan, together, after the medics kind of raised that conversation, where did it take you in terms of your own conversations?
I think for me, it was just a bit of a kind of, oh, thank God moment, because I, having any sort of diagnosis, you know, of any type of breast cancer, any level, any grade, I think it takes away a lot of your femininity anyway, in terms of the, you know, the treatments we have to go through. And, you know, I was really struggling with my body image. So I didn't feel very attractive. I didn't feel, you know, I used to say to Ewan quite frequently, you know, why are you still with me? I definitely had a guilt that it had stopped any sort of intimacy, and penetration was impossible. The pain was unbearable, and you know, and you're absolutely right, you know, as a couple who, you know, our relationship was largely based around penetrative sex over the last, you know, many years, and to have that kind of taken away from you is a huge thing. And I think it just forced us to actually talk. And I know that sounds crazy because, you know, you were sitting here saying, you know, we are a strong couple and, you know, and we are. And we talk about so many things, but we had so many things thrown at us over that first, you know, kind of 4 or 5 years that our relationship in terms of our physical relationship and actually, you know, the kind of impact it was having then on our mental health as well. We never spoke about it. So to be forced to actually, and it was when I was having an oophorectomy, so I was having my ovaries removed, and that was the appointment that Ewan's referring to. Mm. So it was only at that point when we were in the pre-op and we were talking about the medicine that I was on. And I said to the gynecology surgeon, you know, we can't have a physical relationship, you know, because it's like everything's closed up. And he, you know, he looked at my kind of notes and he said, well, it has. He said, because that form of chemotherapy that I was on at the time actually closes the vaginal canal.
Wow.
Now, nobody had ever told us that. And I'd been on that drug for 4 years.
Oh, my God.
I'm just unreal.
Yeah, go on, Fiona, the way you're reacting.
I just think that that's just unreal. I just don't understand why they wouldn't have said, oh, because I know, you know, they give you like a million leaflets, mm-hmm. like when you're first diagnosed and you're like, oh, yeah, I'll read that later. Oh, yeah, I'll read that later. And you do read them. And I know I did, and, you know, went on to Dr. Google, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Only in Macmillan and Breast Cancer Now. I was very
focused.
Yeah.
Don't want anything
else.
There was did you ever do a moving forward course?
I've literally never even heard of a moving forward course.
So Breast Cancer Now, as well as the Someone Like Me service, there's also a helpline where you can just ring, you can speak to breast cancer nurses anytime. And there's also, they do a moving forward course. So basically, there are people in different areas and they will facilitate, it's like a 4-week course, and you set aside like 4 mornings or 4 afternoons, whatever, and you talk about a whole range of subjects. One of the subjects is sex and intimacy and all the different things that you can do, things that you need to look out for, things that you can do to make it better
for yourself. I feel like just with your partner, but
for yourself as well.
I feel like I want to say, Lisa, obviously, in terms of the combination of drugs you had when it came to your chemo infusion, it doesn't mean that everybody having chemotherapy, it would have the same effect on them.
So
let's
not
just put that out there.
Let
me go back to Fiona. In terms of your own body image, what was your treatment, and did the treatment affect how you saw your body?
Yeah, very much so. I started off with chemo, and they were quite aggressive with the chemo. You know, I was lucky. I was only grade 3. Bless you, Lisa. Do you know what I mean? I started off with my chemo. I had 6 months of chemo. I was on Herceptin because I was triple positive. I was allergic to the Herceptin, but I still had to have 18 cycles of that. And that was the first drug that I had as well. They were prepping resus. It was, you know, it was not great for Emma being there, having to see all of that. And then I had surgery, so they were able to remove the lump, but they also reduced my breast as well at the same time. They did say to me, because I had really big boobs, that was what had saved my life, and that was why it didn't spread, because it was quite invasive.
Right.
And then after that, I had 4 weeks of radiotherapy as well.
So are your breasts different sizes now?
They were for a year.
Yeah.
So I was like Nemo. I had one bigger than the other, like walking around in circles.
And that was probably the most difficult part, especially being with a woman. So for both of us, I think I was very conscious that I didn't want to present myself in a way, excuse me, that would make Fiona feel not uneasy, but just
uncomfortable
or any less of a woman.
And almost embarrassed. I almost
became not me because I very rarely wear makeup or get dressed up because I didn't want to be that person and for Fiona to feel that she wasn't. So, or that, I didn't want her looking at my boobs because, in her eyes that they were still perfect. But then flip that round to 18 months later, Fiona lost 3 stone. She got a set of beautiful new boobs. And, there I was thinking...
Because they made me symmetrical.
They made you symmetrical 18 months later and Fiona then lost an awful lot of weight. So all of a sudden then I'm thinking... no one tells you that you could potentially be jealous of your wife when she's going through cancer treatment. Gosh. And, I was. But equally, there was no support for same-sex relationships. Mm. So everything that I Googled is all about how to support your wife through pregnancy. Yeah. Don't know where I am.
That's the wrong podcast.
Wrong podcast. Yeah. So how to support your wife as a man going through breast cancer and how to... approach sex and potentially sex. Yeah. But there was nothing to say, actually, do you know what, Emma? You're going to feel jealous
that
your wife's getting all this attention. Yeah. Or, there was flowers coming through the door and cards and it was all Fiona. And I did. I'm ashamed to say that there were moments when I was incredibly jealous of Fiona. Sounds awful to say that now.
And I knew...
Thanks for being honest.
And I knew that you felt like that. And then that made me feel so guilty and almost ashamed of oh my God, I can't help it. It's not my fault, but...
I never blamed you. It was never an issue for us, but I know
that you felt like that. And then I also felt the same. And in terms of sort of body image and stuff, I'm really, really scarred. It took me almost a year to heal from my first surgery because the wound just wouldn't close. So there's lots and lots of scarring and stuff. But I think this year I kind of embraced it and went, do you know what? This is what I've got. This is what I'm doing. And I was actually in Calendar Girls and literally...
Went for it
and literally,
Stripped off on stage. Absolutely mortified.
You were. not behind anything, literally a bit of bunting and a golf trophy. And
that's amazing. And I think
that was just, for me, that was just really, really important to be able to do that and go, do you know what? It doesn't look perfect, but this is what I've got and I'm just really lucky to still be here.
Yeah. And that's what I find attractive.
Yes.
Yeah. And that, I think, helps when Fiona had that confidence and that acceptance of her body. That's what I continue to find attractive. Mm.
Let me bring in Ewan and Lisa on this point, because, Lisa, you said at the beginning that you were diagnosed with primary and secondary cancer at the same time. And Ewan, it was you who said your wife was given months to live. You are still here. Hooray.
Absolutely. Big yay.
Absolutely. When you've got, literally life or death at your door, and you have survived for longer than the medics suggested you might, even asking the question, I feel stupid because it seems so tiny and parochial. Where does sex come the longer you live, if that doesn't sound utterly bizarre?
It doesn't sound utterly bizarre either, and I can kind of see this from the partner side as well. Mm. Nothing is important at the point of diagnosis and from then on, because we were always working under the assumption or the Dr. Google or stats or one surgery leading into another. As I said at the beginning, nothing else was really there apart from let's just do this. Let's just do what the professionals are telling us to keep her alive. It was literal life support. So anything else, job, money, holidays, whatever, house improvements, were just ridiculously far down the list. Mm. And as the partner, I was at that moment as well, and willingly, obviously, putting my entire life on hold. And by that, I mean everything.
Yeah.
Because it was just a case of, well, look, you know, what I was being told was she might not be here in 6 months, 9 months. So therefore, everything goes on hold, quite frankly. You know, no matter what, you know, I took a heck of a lot of time off work. My employers were incredible. I was in the middle of changing jobs at that point. I'd handed in my notice in my old job and, you know, bless them, they, you know, increased my notice for as long as I required and continued to pay me, you know, throughout those periods. You know, it was just a case of everything goes on hold. But you're right, Victoria. It's almost as long as time goes on, and you know, we're very honest, Lisa has beaten the stats and continues to beat the stats, even though stats mean nothing because they know that they don't count to every individual's case. But the longer time goes on, these conversations of what is quote unquote normal seep back into conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the case of, right, when do we start talking about sex? When do we start talking about intimacy? When do we start talking about putting money aside for a pension? You know, these things which you know were utterly unimportant, you know, during these times, now come into the discourse of slowly but surely seeping in.
And as you're talking, sorry to interrupt. As you're talking, I just want to tell you that Emma and Fiona were then holding hands at that moment. It was the bit about the pension, I think. Not quite sure why that made you hold hands, but anyway.
No, I saw that as well, and that was weird. because I work in that sort of area, and a pension is not romantic, guys.
No, fair enough. Anyway, sorry, Ewan, go on, finish the thought.
No, as I was saying, it just, you know, these things, and it is, it's like osmosis, seep back into the conversation slowly but surely. And now, look, time's gone on, and, you know, cancer is still there at the forefront. You know, Lisa had her treatment yesterday and she has it every 3 weeks, so it's always there. But we can slowly but surely talk about normal stuff that we would never talk about before, because now it's like, well, look, you know, treatment's going well, mm-hmm. and it continues to go well, and it's going all right, so let's talk about these things. So the voices grow stronger over
Understood.
Time, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
No, it makes absolute sense the way you have described it. We mentioned vaginal dryness early on. By the way, I should say, Future Dreams get so many comments and questions about the area of sex and intimacy. And so I really hope this is a useful listen. And thank you to all of you for being so bloody honest, because it really helps. We mentioned vaginal dryness early on. Can we just nail why it happens? And Lisa, you talked about it being unbearably painful because of the dryness. It's as a result of treatment, depending on which treatment you have, correct?
Yeah, because I exactly the same. Exactly the same. And, you know, obviously, we use toys, as you would. Why wouldn't you? But it was when we, you know, started having sex regularly and stuff again and being intimate, there would be so many times where I would cry, because and it used to be awful, because then I would feel, because, you know, you get yourself ready and you think you're ready, and that's the thing, because you feel like you're wet, not to put too fine a point on it, and I have spoken to the breast care nurses as well, and I'm like, but you know, but like, I'm really wet,
and I'm really turned on, and I'm really ready,
and I really, you know, I just want you inside me, kind of thing, and then as soon as we would try to put anything up there, it would be like, oh my God, well, that's not going anywhere.
Then you would be so incredibly disappointed, because she would
And that's why you cried.
Because she would want an orgasm, because mentally she was really and sexy and she was ready and she wanted that intimacy, but it just wouldn't work.
And, you know, and the breast care nurse would say to me, well, yeah, because you can get wet, you know, further down, but further up, no, there's just nothing happening up there.
So what are some of the solutions to that?
You know, using lots of lubricant, taking your time. And there would still be times when, even if we did use lubricants, it still wouldn't make any difference, and you'd be like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Which is just really frustrating.
And learning other ways where you can orgasm comfortably without potentially the penetration.
Yeah.
And other ways just to be intimate as well.
You don't have to have an orgasm.
No, you don't. And we for the intimacy as well. Like we were speaking about it yesterday when Fiona and I always slept face to face, for example. Mm. And then because of the side where her breast cancer was, and she now can't sleep on her...
Can't lie on that side
on that side at all. So now we can't face each other when we go to bed or when we're sleeping. And that intimacy I really, really struggled with because I was forever looking at the back of her. Oh. And you don't think about that. People don't talk to you about those things. Mm. We tried swapping sides of the bed, didn't we? But then she wasn't comfortable.
I didn't like it on that side of the bed.
You don't. The side of the bed is, the side of the bed is sacrosanct.
It's so important, Ewan. You're so right. So important.
And we were exactly the same. Mm. With the dryness, it took me a long time to actually get the confidence to even be remotely physical because I hated my body and I use that word hate because I really mean it. You know, I was disgusted at my own body because I'd had so many surgeries. I've had 15 so far.
Wow.
That have ranged from, you know, breast surgery, I've had spinal surgery, I've had brain surgeries that have left, you know, a lot of scars that are very visible, a lot of scars mentally. And I didn't want you in anywhere near me because I didn't feel like me. You know, slowly, and we're nowhere near, you know, this is still an issue for us, you know, as a couple. You know, I don't think we have truly found a way to fully be as intimate as we want to be because, you know, as you say, things like lubricants can help and, you know, we have tried that, but exactly the same that when you're getting to that penetration point that the pain just becomes so intense. And, you know, like you, I was pulling away in tears because, you know, you've got to this point and you then feel that you've let your partner down. Yeah. So I'm lying crying on you and, you know, like, I'm so sorry, you know, like, you know, you must hate me, you know, and a moment that it's taken a lot to get to that moment of being intimate, you know, and then to get to that point where you're like, okay, this is happening, and you know, we're getting into our groove, you know, and for that to then be stopped, you know, and stopped because of pain. It's almost like a feeling of failure.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And there can be a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy in many ways as well, or the total cycle,
yeah.
You know, which is, look, there is that physical aspect and there is that physical issue which occurs. But then, of course, you know, you've tried it and it's been sore, so it doesn't work. But then actually the next time you try it, then the mental side of it takes over as well.
Yeah. Because you're anxious, because you know that it's going to be sore, and then you're like, oh my God, how do I get over that?
Which of course then just leads to, you know, tension and then makes it potentially 25 times worse. You know, and so the realism about, you know, and again, look, this is us, this is not everybody. Everybody's situation is entirely different, you know, and that's important to say, whether it comes to how treatment affects you physically, mentally, and all these things. It's entirely different for everybody. But
can I just come in there as the opposite way?
Of course. Thinking,
I was just, when I was diagnosed in 2011, my first thought, which is utterly ridiculous, when the surgeon told me was, oh my God, he's really hot.
I love that.
Your body goes into a lockdown. I felt like a block of wood. And it's like someone has got the key, but they've thrown it away and locked your sexual drive in a room, very dark room. You have to fight to get it back and really go for it and think, I'm not going to let this take this away from me.
Thank you, Louise. I'm going to ask, because I always do, what your advice, each of you individually, would advise anybody listening right now who is in a loving relationship and they're really anxious about a cancer diagnosis changing everything, possibly, in terms of intimacy. Fiona, what would you say?
Oh, I would say just keep talking to each other because it's so important to keep that channel of communication open and just be honest with each other as well about how you feel.
Thank you.
Similar. Talk, lots of transparency, and one thing that I do want to say, just listening to Lisa and Fiona around their anxiety about being with their respective others during intimate moments, is take time for yourself. And I encourage Fiona to get to know her body in the absence of myself as well. I think that's my work head coming on. But it's important that women understand their own pleasure. And by doing that themselves, ahead of with their partner, will take that anxiety away, because they'll know what they obviously then go back to talking. And but lots of experimenting with yourself so you're comfortable, it takes that anxiety and that guilt away from you. So just be comfortable with yourself and your own sexuality before you comfortable sharing that with even your partner.
Thank you.
I think the same as the ladies, talking is such a key thing to do, and that's talking to your partner and not being ashamed of having these conversations, because you are going through this together. But also talking to your medical team, and it's something that I wish I'd done, you know, sooner, because it wasn't a conversation that was instigated by my team with myself. So I wish that I had the knowledge and the confidence to actually say to my, you know, my nurses, well, what can I do to help this? You know, because they are there to support you as well. And, you know, and of course there is a, you know, there's a very strong online community on, you know, Instagram, for example, that a lot of us do share our journeys openly. And, you know, so seek out, you know, peers that can support you through it, because it isn't something you should navigate alone. So yeah, just have these conversations, and let's not be embarrassed about talking about sex and intimacy. We've got enough going on with a breast cancer diagnosis without having to, you know, have that shame for something that is totally normal.
I think, you know, following on from that as well, and everyone said talking, and of course that is the ultimate, you know, that is the ultimate answer, and really it's the main answer. But as a partner as well, I would say, almost, I don't say reanalyze your expectations, but almost as well, when it's talking, we're not just talking about talking outside the act. Actually, it sounds strange, but, you know, there's going to be a lot of talking during the act. And, you know, get used to that, understand that. It's not going to be, you know, Basic Instinct style up against the wall.
Speak, you know, for yourself, Ewan.
Well,
might be.
You know,
we
might
a lot
for it.
Yeah. We laughed a lot.
Exactly. And you have to. It's laughing a lot, and actually, especially during those first times, you know, through that, there's going to be a lot of talking, you know, during the act and at that time, and slowly, surely, comfortably, understanding, things are going to go wrong. It's almost going to be like, you know,
starting all over,
at the very first time again, you know, which was probably for all of us, I am sure, a major disappointment. but that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking and actually understanding and questioning, and, you know, re-comforting, etc., during the act, is incredibly important.
It's like that Frank Sinatra song, I Did It My Way, because so many people are jumping in to give you advice, not necessarily medical people. And it's like, stay away from the advice giver, stay away from toxic people. You really can that. You've got an excuse. And yeah, just do it your way.
How have you all found talking on this podcast about sex?
It's fine.
I think it's so cool, Fiona.
Thank you. I think it's just been really lovely to have an open and honest conversation about it, because you guys will know that when people ask you after your treatment, or you know why you're still doing, you having your treatment, but when kind of things are finished or stabilizing, you know, when people say, oh, how are you doing? You're like, do you really want to know? Because you actually don't, like, do you?
You don't really want me to go into how I'm feeling, details.
Or, you know, how sore I am because of all the drugs and stuff that you've taken. And
that's actually a really important point, because I think people think that it's just while you're going through the treatment that
then
it's a
struggle.
Where our biggest challenge is have happened post-treatment, when normality, to what Ewan was saying, I think that's why we held hands at that point, because that's when the real work starts. Because when you're going through the treatment, we was on a train ride that someone else was driving. We had no control over our lives. But once all of a sudden they release you and you've got responsibility for your life again, that's when the real work started.
Yeah.
So
you sort of nosedive at that point, don't you? Where you're back to normal.
Absolutely.
So far from normal.
This is our life, you know. We aren't going to get back to, you know, I'm never going to be cured. So we've had to kind of learn how to live differently, you know, but it is, you know, we have had to make adaptations and, you know, people talk about that new normal. And I think that applies to every aspect of your life, including, you know, your sex life. And I think it's been quite empowering. I don't know about you guys, but, you know, I think it's been quite empowering talking about it and, you know, hopefully kind of breaking down that stigma. And if people actually see us talking about it and hopefully listen to this podcast and think, oh my God, I'm not the only person feeling like this, because I felt I was, you know, and I knew I wasn't, because obviously I knew that, you know, there was lots of other people being treated for breast cancer, you know, whether it's primary, you know, whether it's metastatic, but you feel very isolated. So, you know, I really hope that, you know, people listen to this and, you know, just realize that and normalize it a little bit.
It's been really good to talk about it, you know, from my point of view as well, because, you know, I'm very lucky. I've got a great support network, you know, around family, friends. But, you know, let's be honest, if they come up to me in the street or we're chatting and they go, oh, how's Lisa doing? I'm not going to go, well, do you know what? Her vagina is really dry and I'm finding it really hard to penetrate.
Thank God you won't do that in the street.
I'm not going to lead with that. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
So, you know, to chat about it in a situation like this with, you know, people who are going through it as well, and hopefully it has helped. You know, perhaps actually that's a conversation you could have with your mates, and actually more people could, you know, speaking honestly about sex and intimacy.
I think you all deserve so much credit for being honest and open. And I'm going to say, Ewan, in particular, you. Now, maybe it's sexist to actually say that, because, you know, generalising massively, you know, some men do not talk about their feelings, do not want to be honest about stuff like this. So I'm going to say absolute credit to you, but to all of you, honestly,
if
I can say that. Thank you. That's all we ask on this podcast, that people come on and talk and be as honest as they can be. Thank you to all our guests today. And Then Came Breast Cancer is brought to you by the Future Dreams Breast Cancer Charity, which provides practical, emotional and psychological support for anyone diagnosed with the disease. It's a factory original and 6'6" production.
Our podcast is intended to be a message of support for everyone who has been touched by breast cancer. And that's why our guests share their personal and unique stories with you. They express their personal opinions, which don't necessarily reflect those of Future Dreams or our sponsors. Our guests' individual stories do not constitute medical advice and shouldn't be treated in any way as a substitute for professional expertise or a consultation with healthcare professionals. This podcast is not offering to treat your cancer, but it is trying to help by talking about it. So hopefully you realise that you are not alone.